Okay, welcome. You're listening to the Kraz Files podcast with Adam, and it's Monday the 19th of November 2018, going fast. And as usual, look, everything's up on my website, krazfiles.com. Lots of great articles up there, lots of challenging stuff, getting people involved. It's really been doing well. And the podcast go up there as well. And you can also grab them over at iTunes if you want to subscribe there. But I put them up on the Facebook page, the Kraz Files. And I'm also over at Twitter, and also there's a YouTube channel under the Kraz Files if you want to have a look at the videos up there. And that's also linked to the website as well. And there's lots of original content going up on the website and YouTube videos I find interesting. So everything I really put out now is... been connected to this website, so it's all in the one place. So check that out, krazfiles.com, C-R-A-Z. Now, have a great podcast tonight. Quite a different podcast, but it's going to be very interesting information in regards to Port Arthur. And anyone who's been following this podcast since its beginnings knows how much I've tried to go into Port Arthur and share material and get people discussing this. It's an incredible case. And so, of course, the Port Arthur massacre of 28 and 29th of April 1996 was a mass shooting in which 35 people were killed. This is in Australia, in Tasmania, and 23 wounded in Port Arthur, Tasmania. The murderer, Martin Bryant, had a subnormal IQ and intellectual disabilities. He pleaded guilty for the incident and was given 35 life sentences without possibility of parole. So they gagged this whole thing, and we were never allowed to mention any of it again. But it's getting to the point now, seriously, where people want answers, and there's some serious problems in regards to this case indeed, and we're trying to cover as much as we can. But my guest tonight is Oscar Zimmerman, and he's an Aussie bloke there, and he's written a great book which we're going to talk about tonight. And the book is The Second Empty Chair, The Port Arthur Paradox. And I've been going into this material by Oscar. It's very exciting. Oscar, how are you going? Welcome.
Very good, mate. Thank you for inviting me.
Why don't we get to know you a little bit for all our new listeners? There's a lot of new listeners joining in all the time out there, perhaps even in other countries who might have heard about this case and know about it. And also for so many Australians who are thirsty for more information about this case, I don't blame them. We all are. I mean, it's an unbelievable thing, and we're trying to do our best. How did you talk about your work a little bit and who you are and how you fell into this, and we'll lead into your book and some of this amazing information.
Sure. I grew up in Melbourne, the usual white middle class guy. Went to high school, went to university, got a white collar job, and I was just out of high school when it happened, 1996. And so I saw what was in the media. I wasn't really interested in the details because I was chasing girls and earning money and driving cars, just like a lot of people were. And then a couple of years ago, just sort of out of the blue, a few things coalesced in my brain. And I learned a little bit more about the details of what actually happened. And that got me thinking, well, hang on a minute. This is there's got to be more to this. So the issue for me was the soap powder decoy. And we can talk about that in a minute, but that's one of the key questions that anyone who's calling for an inquiry or an investigation is saying, this is something that doesn't make sense and needs to be investigated. So that was sort of what got me into it. And talking to people about what happened, once you reveal you're a skeptic, you get two responses. Mm. Either people say, oh, yeah, me too. I always knew there was something fishy about it. Or, no, he did it. He alone is guilty. He's the worst person in the world. It's him. End of story. And the main rejection is that there's no plausible alternative. Okay, what we've been given is all of the facts. We may not know everything, but it all hangs together, and he did it. So I wrote this book as an attempt to present a plausible alternative, to say, well, hang on a minute. Given the facts that we know, we've got witness statements, we've got maps, we've got the court documents and the prosecution, we've got some photos. How so putting this out there, my background is in statistics and statistical analysis. So what is possible? What is probable? What is impossible? these are things that we can sift through scientifically. And we, if you imagine you're spreading a bunch of papers out on the desk, and over on the left-hand side you can say, that's the less possible stuff, okay? That maybe didn't happen. And then in the middle, there's stuff that could happen, and maybe it did. And on the other side, you've got, okay, there's definitely things that did happen, okay? 35 people died. The seascape burnt down. Martin Bryant was caught crawling out of the wreckage. So the problem that we face is there's this grey area in between, and trying to make sense of it all has been, I believe, deliberately confused in order to make people just give up and say, okay, I can't be bothered. I've got other problems in my life. I'll just ignore it. So what I tried to do was write a novel that reads like an action thriller. I'm not Tom Clancy or Lee Child, but I read a lot of their books and I like their writing style. And part of what got me, do you remember there was that Tom Cruise movie they made called One Shot, Jack Reacher?
The Jack Reacher movie?
Yeah, the Jack Reacher movie. You remember that?
Yeah.
Okay. It was based on a book that Lee Child wrote called One Shot. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
I read the book. I haven't seen the movie. I'm allergic to Tom Cruise.
Right? It's painful.
But in this, I'm not sure if they did it in the movie, but in the book, the thing that they've got all of this evidence that points to this homeless guy as the killer, right? And they've got all of these DNA and fingerprints and boot prints and clothes and fiber. And the district attorney even got all of the coins out of the parking station meter and fingerprinted them all to get the guy's thumbprint to prove that he was the one who put the coin in the parking station meter, right? And that's what tells Reacher that it's a setup.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so much evidence. And he says to his colleague, he says, you know, in all the investigations I've done, you know how many times I've seen this much evidence? Never. It's what we call an orgy of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So this is what brings me to the soap powder decoy, because there's a lot of questions we could talk about. I've got a few notes here, but the thing is, about 12 o'clock or 11:30 on the Sunday, a phone call came into the Nubina police station. It was a hoax, a phone call tip-off that said there's a heroin drug stash at a tourist site called Saltwater River, which is about 35 minutes drive the opposite direction to Port Arthur. So if you can imagine, the Tasmania itself is shaped a bit like a love heart, and hanging off the bottom is another bit that's a bit like a love heart. And so Port Arthur is on the bottom, set the southeastern corner,
mm-hmm.
and this saltwater creek is on the opposite corner in the middle, right up the top. It's 35 minutes on a dirt road, absolutely the middle of nowhere. So the only two cops in the area get in their police car and they drive for 35 minutes all the way out there on the dirt road, and they find a glass jar purportedly full of soap powder. And they radio this in. The radio's a bit patchy. It's not really working. There's not much mobile phone signal because it's 1996. And just as they are there, 35 minutes in the wrong direction, somebody's shooting up the cafe in Port Arthur. So my question is this, right? Where's the glass jar? Was it tested for fingerprints or DNA? Are Martin Bryant's fingerprints on the glass jar? Because the issue is, if you want to decoy the police away from an area, all you've got to do is make the phone call. And they're going to try, they're duty bound to follow up the lead, right? What is the point of driving there yourself and placing an artifact for them to find? Okay. Martin Bryant has a 66 IQ. Okay. He's as clever as an 11-year-old kid. Okay, I've got witness statements from people who've played chess with him in prison, and they testify that he is as dumb as a box of rocks. That's their words. He is dumb. Okay, so he can play a bit of chess, but he ain't no strategic mastermind. Okay, so for somebody to think up this hoax decoy and then travel down there, because it's an hour and a half from Hobart, travel all the way down there, stash it, and then drive back, raises more questions. Okay, here's the thing. If Martin Bryant dreamed up this decoy and then drove down and stashed the soap powder there either 24 hours or 48 hours before, why didn't Petra Wilmot say that they had gone there? Because Petra Wilmot had been with him in the week beforehand. She only left on the Sunday morning to go to her parents. They'd spent the entire week together. Okay, now she doesn't mention this. So that raises more questions.
Could you talk about Petra a little bit as well?
Yeah, I'll get to that. So she doesn't say anything about them taking a half a day trip to stash a glass jar at this out of the way tourist destination in the middle of nowhere. So either he didn't do it because she was with him the whole time, or they both did it and she's lying. I don't know the answer to that. I don't even know if there was a soap powder jar found, because there's no photos of it. Nothing was tendered in evidence at the court case because nothing was cross-examined. So it's one of those questions where the police radio comes alive and says, oh, we found this this soap powder decoy. It's at the perfect time for them to be out of the way, and the massacre happens. So that really sort of stuck with me and just sort of niggled away. I think there's more to this. And so I like you, did some research online. I'd found Paul Moder doing doing his film. He's got a Dropbox folder full of files and books. I read the Keith Allen Noble, the McGregor, the Gunsmith's Guide to Port Arthur, the Prelude to a Port Arthur Inquiry. And the issue that you've got to really read a lot of different books about it, because some people don't cover things. Other people misinterpret or misemphasize some things. So I've read a lot about it, and I'm sort of like I'd use that analogy about the papers on the desk. I'm shuffling some things that people think are really important. Now I'm shuffling them all the way over to the left-hand side. For instance, Joe Viles makes a lot about the blue Vitara or RAV4 being disabled with a shot through the throttle cable Seascape.
Yep.
He has this whole creation about that, which I don't agree with. I just think it was a lucky shot. Okay? And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but I just think it was a lucky shot, because by then the plan was not to kill any more people. It was just to make enough noise and disruption so the police knew that they had to come to Seascape. And that blocked off the rescuers getting down to Port Arthur and traumatized the survivors even more. So while the siege was on at Seascape, it was very difficult for the emergency crews to get through and help the people at Port Arthur that didn't die. And the police had a barbecue. There was a barbecue put on for the police for several hours while the victims were still doing the best they could with no resources a few minutes further south. So that's another question. Why was this barbecue put on for police? Why weren't the police taken straight in to secure the crime scene and help bring comfort and medical supplies to the people who'd been shot at? It seems to me that there was a lot of steps taken to maximise the trauma of the people who were there. And I believe that was done deliberately. I believe there was a lot of psychological, psychiatrist involvement in the planning. We can get onto that in a bit later if you like. So I started to do some research, and I've made freedom of information inquiries to various government departments, Department of Justice in Tasmania. And the Department of Justice wrote me an interesting letter. They said to me that, I asked for the brief. Some people on the internet said, oh, you're not going to get anywhere. You need to go to and actually request the brief against Martin Bryant, because all these conspiracy theories saying that the records are sealed is rubbish. You just need to ask and you'll be given. So I called their bluff and I wrote a Freedom of Information Act, put in the money and sent it off, and they wrote me back and they said, basically, we've received your application. It all checks out. You've paid the fee. The Department of Justice does not hold the information you have requested. I'm advised that some of the information may be held by the Department of Public Prosecutions, and some of the information may be held by Tasmanian Police. Pursuant to Section 61I of the Act, the Director of Public Prosecutions is excluded from the operation of the Act unless the information relates to the administration of the office. So what they're saying is the people who've got the information are not subject to Freedom of Information requests. It's locked away, which is apparently very unusual. So when I posted that on the internet in reply to these people who'd been telling me to ask, they shut up and went away. So they were talking out of their butt. So this got me, having done all this research, the average person isn't going to do this. I'm I understand that people aren't going to spend hours and hours sifting through and reading and writing emails and reading the replies. So I thought the way to do this is to write a novel that reads like an action thriller but contains the elements of truth. So you watch the film Black Hawk Down and you can understand what happened. It's not exactly what happened. There's been liberties taken. There's some poetic license, but it's pretty close. You get the idea. So for this particular thing, I think I've covered the basics of what happened in a plausible alternative story, which says it is within the scope of imagination that this happened. You don't need a gigantic conspiracy. You just need four or five key people who are authorised with the right authority to talk to the people like the Premier of Tasmania, and it happens. It may well go further beyond that, all the way up to the Prime Minister or beyond. I don't know. I can't tell. But I know that from in my imagination, in the story, it doesn't need to be this gigantic conspiracy that people allege would be impossible to cover up. Somebody would have talked. Which brings me to the next point. I think that the operation was a balls up. I think there was a double cross involved against the people who were running the operation. So they thought they had everybody on their side, but there was a faction within the mission who were actually following orders from someone else. It's documented that there was factional infighting between the state and federal security agencies, Interpol, ASIO, the federal police, the state police, the state's SOG. And you might want to just chop out a bit of that because
you're right.
Just going to realign. So they realised what they were up against. When they shot up the cafe instead of the real target, and there was a bunch of ASIO agents inside the cafe who were shot, the message got out loud and clear. If you rock the boat, you'll be next. And so that's why anybody who tries to dig into this is very quickly comes up against, first of all, a polite threat and then a very serious one. I can't remember who it was. Somebody posted a comment on one of my threads that they had spoken to their newly elected member of parliament and they'd taken some information in and said to them, look, we want to get an investigation into Port Arthur, and spoke about a few of these things, these questions that we're talking about. And the person had never heard of any of this before and said, yeah, that sounds really interesting. There's obviously more to it. The questions are valid, leave it with me and I'll follow it up. 2 weeks later, they rang again to say, hey, how are you going? You know, what's the progress? And instead of being polite and cheerful, the Member of Parliament was terrified and angry and basically said, no, it's closed. He did it. I'm not going to talk about it anymore. Goodbye. And hung up. So obviously they made some questions and made some inquiries, and the powers that be, whoever they are, quickly dropped the hammer on this person and said, if you want to keep your job, you'll leave this well enough alone. So there's a culture of silence and secrecy around this in the government. I don't think everybody knows exactly why they're keeping it shut. They've just been told to keep it shut for national security reasons or something. But then you've got people like Waleed Ali, who interviewed Paul Motor, and Waleed said, well, Bryant pleaded guilty. What more do you need? Well, Waleed, you're a lawyer. There's thousands of examples of people who plead guilty but didn't do the crime. You know, have you ever heard of a plea bargain? That's what it is. So Waleed's being deliberately deliberately tricky with his words here. Okay. So keep in mind, Martin Bryant's been held in solitary confinement for 5 months. He gets a new defence lawyer, and I use the word defence in inverted commas because John Avery was previously on the prosecution team. And John Avery, when he got out of prison for fraud, admitted that he told Martin's mum, Carlene, to tell Martin that she wouldn't come and see him again unless he pled guilty. So we've got cruel and unusual punishment. We've got an 11-year-old intellect locked in a box, solitary confinement, a corrupt lawyer who's determined to get a guilty plea no matter what. You've got the media juggernaut splashing his photo around everywhere, just saturation coverage, telling everybody this is the man, this is the killer. And I'm surprised he held out for 5 months. Like, Martin has my utmost respect for trying to clear his name. He just had no help. Everything was stacked against him. It was like a snail in front of a steamroller. So the problems begin when you start reading the documents of the transcript of his interview, the court documents, right? The title of my book comes from Judy Tierney. She's a journalist, and she followed the cops into Martin Bryant's house the first time when they opened it up. And she looked around, and it wasn't clean, but it wasn't, messy. And she didn't see any guns. There was no big stashes of ammunition, just basic living mess, like it was a house that had been lived in. But then there's this side room that's quite clean and empty, and all there is a lamp and a table and two chairs. There's some gun magazines on the some papers on the table. And she said it just looked as if two people had sat there going over the plan one last time and then left the house forever. So my question is, Bryant lived alone. Who was sitting in the other chair? Was it Petra? She'd gone to her parents' place. I don't know who it is. So that's why I came up with this character, Warren, in the book, who performs the fictional task of being the actual shooter. So who did the shooting? It's the first question. Once you accept that Martin Bryant didn't do it, he physically didn't have the ability to put to pull off 19 headshots in 21 seconds. It just he couldn't have done it. So who did it? Why did they do it? Why were they hired? And why was Martin framed for it? These are sort of follow-on questions. You start with this original question: did he do it? Yes or no? The answer is I don't believe he did. And so there's this tree of other questions that then grows out from that root. So the shooter. There's people who say that it was a Mossad-trained, Green Beret-style sniper Rambo, Joe Viles, and the Ted Sarong say that there was some satanic accuracy in his shooting skills to get 19 headshots in 21 seconds around the cafe.
You did. I have that
But
book by Joe, Deadly Deception at Port Arthur. We have the original book. He was talking about Israeli intelligence.
I don't know if Israeli intelligence was involved. Personally, I'm skeptical, but I'm keeping an open mind. But my research shows that it's not necessary to be that very tip of the spear. Okay? It's not necessarily required. There's a technique called point shooting, which I've referred to on my Facebook page and my blog. And point shooting is a technique to aim a rifle without using the sights. And it can be learned in a matter of weeks of just training with a pellet gun. And most militaries in the world teach a version of it to their infantry soldiers. There's plenty of civilians who can do it. You can just go on YouTube and type in point shooting, and you'll have an instruction video on how to teach yourself to shoot a rifle pretty accurately without using the sights. I know a man in Victoria who has recreated the cafe scene on private land using an AR-15, and he has hit 19 targets in 21 seconds. So it can be done. This guy's been shooting competitions in his life. He's very familiar with the AR-15 platform. He's put thousands of rounds through it, so it's like an extension of his own arm. By contrast, Martin Bryant hadn't fired more than 10 rounds out of his in his entire life. He was terrified of the recoil and the noise that it made. So that's the shooting has a lot of questions over it, and people say, oh, everybody was so close in the cafe that he could have just walked up and gone boom, boom, boom. They're all, everybody was crouching under the tables, and it's easy enough to do. Well, it's easy to say that, but if you actually look at the firearm they recovered, the AR-15 has a Colt 4x20 scope on top, which sits in between the sights and is used for shooting at ranges of 100 to 400 meters, competition shooting. Okay. In the cafe, that scope would have completely blocked the normal sights that you would use for up close shooting. I've got some photos on my blog, and you can see them of people who actually mount iron sights at 45 degrees down the side of the barrel of their rifle. So if you can imagine, you're holding the rifle vertically using the long distance scope to the top, and then you could just tip it 45 degrees, the scope moves out of the way, and you can then use the iron sights for close up targets. That's how they get around the problem of using a scoped rifle at short distances. These are like Olympic style events where they're testing skill and accuracy over time, and the targets are ranged up close and far away. So you need to be able to use the scope for the far away targets, but you also need to be able to quickly change to iron sights. Martin's rifle didn't have those backup iron sights. So whoever was using that rifle, I believe, was trained in point shooting, because then they can shoot from the hip and still get that level of accuracy. It can be done. So Jim Laycock and Graham Collier both got a good look at the shooter, and their witness statements say it was not Martin Bryant. And those witness statements are dated pretty close to the shooting. Jim Laycock's witness statement was the same day.
Just a little bit important there.
Yes. And if you notice, if you're like me, you sit down and you do a statistical analysis of the witness statements. The ones that are taken very close, like on the day or on the Sunday after, are the ones that say it wasn't Martin Bryant. Any time after that, about a week later or two weeks later, or in Nicholas Cheok's case, 10 weeks later, Nicholas Cheok's witness statement says, oh, it was definitely Martin Bryant. Yeah, the guy I've seen in the paper, that's him. I believe that Nicholas Cheok truly believed that it was who he saw, but I don't believe that that's who he saw. There's enough research now in terms of memory and how susceptible our memory is to trauma and to suggestion, especially with the media smashing Martin's face everywhere, saying this is the man, first pictures of the killer.
Absolutely.
That embeds it into the public psyche.
Yep.
And you get situations where three or four people see the same thing, they remember it differently. But after that media smashing it into everybody, your memory physically puts his face onto the body. It can be done, and it's been proven to be done.
Absolutely.
So Nicholas Cheok's witness statement is very interesting, not only for that matter, because it was taken 10 weeks after it actually happened, but what he describes beforehand. So Robert and Helene Saltzman and Jim Pollard and Rose Nixon were all out driving on holiday in Rose's husband's brand new BMW, or brand new for him, the secondhand BMW. When the Cheoks arrived at the Port Arthur toll booth, the shooting had all pretty much happened, and the yellow Volvo had come up and parked in the exit lane next to the gold BMW, which was parked the wrong way. They'd driven it in, turned around, and then driven it out the in lane. So both cars blocked vehicle access to the Port Arthur area. And Nicholas Cheok and his mother and her friend pulled up, and the two people in the BMW were waving their hands as if to say, shoo, shoo, go away, don't come in. And that was Rose Nixon and Jim Pollard. Nicholas Cheok saw a blonde man sitting in the driver's seat of the Volvo, and next to him, a woman about 45 years old. And in the back seat, a man about 45 years old. The man in the back seat gets out of the car, having talking and arguing with these three people sitting inside the car. The blonde man then gets out, and they're arguing in the street in between these two vehicles. The woman in the yellow Volvo stays in her seat. The people in the BMW stay in their seat. The blonde man then walks around the front of the Volvo to the back door. So he walks past the woman, the passenger's door, opens the back door of the Volvo, pulls out what Nicholas Cheok terms an Arnold Schwarzenegger type gun, which was either the AR-15 or the FN Fowl, completes his circuit around the car and confronts Robert Saltzman, and then shoots him in the chest point blank. He then shoots Jim Pollard and Rose Nixon from the BMW, hauls out Helene Saltzman and shoots her beside the Volvo. Then, at this time, Nicholas Cheok's mother's friend has put the car in reverse, and they're reversing away as fast as they can go. So they don't exactly see what happens then. But this raises questions. Why did Robert and Helene Saltzman sit in the yellow Volvo with the gunman with a hot smoking AR-15 in the footwell next to them? Just ask yourself, if you're listening to this and you're at the scene of a mass shooting and the gunman drives up to you and says, get in the car, he doesn't have a gun on him. The gun's in the back on the opposite side of the car, so it's not really even within reach of him. Wouldn't you run away into the forest? Like, the trees were right there. Instead, they got in, had a conversation with him, that then turned into an argument, and they were all shot. So the police didn't look into the backgrounds of Robert and Helene Saltzman or Jim Pollard, and it just beggars belief. Like, what in blazes was going on? I know a little bit about firearms, and if I had sat in the car like that, my first reflex is to unload the rifle, just make it safe. It's got a magazine in it. You pop the magazine out, rack the little lever that pops the round. Anyone who's watched TV can do that. And yet Robert Saltzman sat next to a hot smoking AR-15 that had just shot 30 people and then allowed the killer to get out, retrieve the rifle from next to him and shoot him. And that's undisputed. That's a witness statement from an impartial observer. So I do not know what is going on there, but there's a big rabbit hole that involves those people, and the police never followed that up. There's been no information released about them or what links they had to Martin Bryant. There's no.
And that was supposed to be Martin that did that shooting?
Allegedly, yeah. Well, that's what the Bug QC says, that he shot them. Yeah. So crikey. I believe that Nicholas Chiok's memory of the event was fine, but I believe that the media saturation subconsciously put Martin's face onto the man who was doing the shooting. It didn't hurt that the man who was doing the shooting looked very similar, not identical, but pretty close. So
you're alluding a little bit there to multiple shooters then? To what the people saw before you were talking about and this guy? Do you think there was more than one or?
Not personally. I don't think there was more than one. There doesn't need to be more than one. One person could have done everything that the evidence says that they did. There were reports of multiple shooters at the start, but there was also reports of a full auto M16, which either disappeared or was simply misidentified by an overzealous journalist. So a bit like Sandy Hook, a bit like Mandalay Bay, you know, there's these reports of other shooters, but I haven't seen any actual evidence that they were there. And from what I can see from the evidence, it's not required in order to fill in any gaps. So it's possible there were, but I don't know. The next thing that we've got is the lies that were told in court. Ooh, it's not nice to lie in court.
So-called court.
Okay, I'm only going to touch on two things. So first of all, back to Walid Ali. Okay, Walid says there was a trial. No, there was no trial. Mm-hmm. A trial involves examination of evidence and cross-examination of witnesses. What there was a hearing. So Martin Bryant was kept in solitary confinement for 5 months and under extreme pressure that I doubt any one of us could have overcome, he pled guilty. And so what happened then was a very simple formality. Okay, you've pled guilty. The prosecution gets to spin a story for the judge and the judge then passes sentence. So in the court hearing, it wasn't a trial, it was a hearing. There was no cross-examination of the evidence, and certain witnesses were specifically not called. Wendy Skerr was told she was not welcome to come to the court and she would not be called to give evidence. So Damien Bug, the QC, lied to the judge at least twice. I'm not going to go into all of the problems. I'm just going to touch on two here. The listeners can read more if they like later on, okay? The judge asked if the shotgun was used in the massacre, and Bug said no. It stayed in the boot of the Volvo where it was found at the toll booth. Okay. Now, this conflicts with Wendy's testimony that she picked shotgun pellets out of Dennis Olsen, and that's verified by the paramedics who attended to him as well. Now, I haven't seen this report, but other people have mentioned to me there's reports of a body in the cafe that did not have a head. So if the shooter was shooting people with an AR-15, the high-velocity rounds go straight through. But if somebody was hit in the head with a shotgun blast at close range, that would remove the head. And if Dennis Olsen was behind that and got hit with some of the flying spray, that would explain these two instances. The other thing is that the USAS 12 shotgun holds 20 shells in the magazine. And when the police recovered it from the boot of the Volvo, there were 19 recovered. So either he didn't load the magazine full, or he fired, one round was fired inside the cafe. When interviewed, Martin said that he did not fire the shotgun at all because he was terrified of the recoil or something malfunctioning. You read through the interview transcript, Martin Bryant was a collector. He was a firearms enthusiast, only a manner of having them to admire on the wall or in his possession. He wasn't really interested in actually shooting anything, or animals or people. The second lie in the court hearing is about timing. Okay, Damien Bugg says that Martin Bryant killed David and Sally Martin between 11:45 and 12:40 in the afternoon. That's in the court documents. Okay. That's his timing. If you draw a map around, if Martin left his house at 11 o'clock, as he says in the interview, and then drives down, it'd take him about an hour and a half to get down there. The problem is that Andrew Simmons was waiting for a lift to the manager's retreat at 10:30, and the car he was waiting for was 10 minutes late. So he's standing at the front of his house just across the road and up a bit from Seascape, and he's checking his watch every 2 minutes. 10 minutes goes past when waiting for someone, right? 10:40 a.m., there's two clear gunshots from Seascape, and that's when David was widely shot. However, Martin was nowhere near the area at the time. He was putting $15 of petrol in the Volvo at Tarana, which is a five-minute drive further north. So it was 10:45, and Buck said it was 11:45. It does not gel, because from Tarada, Martin did not drive south to Port Arthur. He continued along to the west and went surfing at Roaring Beach. Now, I would encourage everybody to either look at the photos of the maps that I've got on my blog, or just go to Google Maps and look at it, type in Hobart and then Tarada and then Roaring Beach, and you can see where he drove. So he comes down the neck, goes to Tarana, puts in $15 fuel, and then he goes west all the way across to Roaring Beach from Nubina, and he has a swim for about 20 minutes. Then he comes back to Nubina, and he has a toasted sandwich and a cappuccino at the bakery in Nubina. Sorry, Mario, just got to pause it for a second. I've got to turn the light on in here. It's gone dark.
You're right.
That's better. So between 11:45 and 12:30, Martin is sitting in a cafe in Nubina eating a toasty cheese sandwich. The police did not follow up on his alibi. They did not go and interview the owners of the cafe and say, did a blonde guy come in here and have a toasted cheese sandwich about midday on the Sunday? Because if they did, that would have exonerated Martin because he was nowhere in the area. So back to our Google Maps, he leaves the cafe at about 12:10 to 12:15, and he continues a counterclockwise circuit of this little heart-shaped peninsula. He drives past Roger Lana's place but does not speak to him, and he drives past the Port Arthur Historic Site. He slows down and he wants to go in, but he doesn't have the money for the entry fee. And we'll read through a bit of this in the interview transcript in a minute. But he then hijacks this BMW, puts the hostage in the boot, waving his rifle around, leaves a woman and child beside the road with his Volvo, drives down to Seascape, and then his next memory is burning. So the problem is that when the BMW arrived in Seascape would have been about 12:40 in the afternoon, long before the shooting even happened. His next memory is 7:30 the next morning, burning and crawling his way out of Seascape. So he's missing the entire afternoon and all night from his memory. Personally, I believe he was drugged with a combination of rohypnol and scopolamine, the date rape drug, which knocked him out, wiped his memory, and he was intended to die in the fire, and it was all wrapped up nice and neatly. Unfortunately, they mistimed the dosage, or they left it too late, and he was able to get out and deny everything. So that's basically how my story runs. There's another shooter. They get Bryant and stuff him into a bed in Seascape, and then a real shooter goes and does the shooting and then rendezvous back at the Seascape. There's other inconsistencies, which if you want to, we can go into in detail. There was a second yellow Volvo spotted inside the historic site, which is very strange. There were two women driving this second yellow Volvo. Jay Nichols was a young boy hitchhiking up the road, and he saw the Volvo do a double back.
Patsy Volvo.
Yes, correct.
Wow.
We have got Gay Lind buying selling $50 worth of marijuana to a funky smelling blonde haired guy who was able to restart their touring van, which had a disconnected battery. In surprising contrast, because Martin Bryant had absolutely no mechanical ability at all. In fact, he had nearly frozen to death on the open ocean in his boat. With his first girlfriend, Joanetta Manuani, because they ran out of fuel and he had a spare tank of fuel, but he didn't know how to connect the hose to the petrol tank in the boat. So that whoever it was who paid them $50 in cash for marijuana, when Martin Bright himself says he did not have the money for the entry fee to get into the site, there's somebody else running around there with money.
You're alluding to a body double almost, like another Martin Bryant, like an actor that was going around sort of being someone in a way. Yeah.
Someone who has the skills to shoot that many people in a row, looks kind of like him, has a busted nose because Kate Scott's boyfriend, his name eludes me, Kate Scott's boyfriend, whoever he is, I've forgotten your name, said that he was like a boxer and he'd been in a fight because he had a squashed nose. So if you look at my Facebook feed or my blog, the number one name on my personal list is David Everett. David Everett was an ex-SAS trooper. Had gone to fight with the Karen rebels in Burma, became a bank robber and a drug importer in Australia, using his SAS training to plan and execute robberies in order to fund his friends back in Southeast Asia, and dobbed in and was in prison at the time that this happened. But he wasn't in his cell. He'd been beaten up in the prison. And at the time Port Arthur happened, he was in the hospital. Lower security, much more people coming and going. Is it possible that he was smuggled out of the prison hospital, put on a plane to Tasmania and told to do this in exchange for immunity from other crimes that he could have been prosecuted with? I don't know. It's possible. Is it plausible? There's weirder things that have happened. So if you look at the photos of David Everett and Martin Bryant, if David Everett put on a blonde wig, they could be cousins. And Everett had the skills to pull off the shooting. He had the presence of mind and the ability to calm his nervous system, which was trained into him in the SAS. Because when Terry McCarthy is interviewing Jamie inside Seascape, he's very calm, completely in control, cheerful, cracking jokes, and very careful not to get tied down into anything. He never makes any promises, and he keeps it all vague and light. And if you ask me, was that the sort of training that SAS people get in case they're captured? What's the word for it? SEER, survival, evasion, resistance, and escape. There's the waft, there's the scent. There's the hint that the person who's negotiating with Terry McCarthy is well trained and is running rings around the police negotiator. So was it David? I don't know. The guy's he's dead now, but I kind of grudgingly admire the guy for the life that he had. When he was doing bank robberies, there was an unnamed accomplice that he had, who he didn't dob in, and he's still at large. They suspect he's also former SAS. So there's a whole There is a group of people who've been highly trained by our government, done their service to the country, but then struggle when they leave the army. And is it beyond the realm of possibility that one of these was approached in a bar and offered a job? You know, you either get immunity from the crimes or we'll give you $50,000 to leave to your family. In my book, the shooter is dying of AIDS, which he contracted by fighting off a home invasion. And so he's got nothing left to live for. He doesn't want to, you know, waste away, because in 1996, the prognosis was pretty poor. And so he does the shooting, escapes from Seascape in the morning, and then jumps off a cliff and ends his own life, neatly tying up all the loose ends. So I really don't want to accuse David Everett, because there's 100 blokes like him with similar skills and similar looking that could have done it. He's just got the unlucky situation of having his mug on his book, Shadow Warrior, which I recommend you get from the library and have a read. The morgue truck, we could talk about that all day. The 22-bed refrigerated morgue truck that was built just in time for the massacre to happen, and was certainly useful, but instead of being retained in case future things happened, it was decommissioned and then sold. So it's very strange that they built such a big refrigerated van for a massive disaster in Tasmania, of all places. I mean, Melbourne and Sydney were the places that had had previous mass shootings or plane crashes. But questions remain about who commissioned the morgue truck to be built and what the reasons for that were.
It sounds like it's been made up, doesn't it? It sounds like it's made up. But people will say, you're just making that up, this morgue truck that was made to specially carry the same amount of bodies almost taken out of there. I mean, it sounds like you're making it up. It's unbelievable.
If you were watching this on TV, you would throw your shoe at the television and say, oh, come on, you don't expect me to believe that.
A morgue truck to carry all the bodies.
With just the right number of bodies too. Very strange. And so next is my personal favourite. I've developed a fondness for the FN FAL style battle rifle, which is what the Australians would call an SLR, was the Australian Army rifle for quite some time, through the 60s and 70s, 80s. Even some reserve units had it in the 90s. And I confirm that the Tasmanian garrison in Hobart would have had at least a stash of SLR rifles in their infantry when this went down. So there's photos of this rifle lying in the gutter of an outbuilding. So it wasn't in the house when the house burnt down. It was in one of the sheds outside. And it's in the roof, in the gutter outside. So it didn't get burnt, but it was smashed. The butt of it had been smashed onto something very hard, and the spring had come out of the back. So it wasn't able to be fired, but was that done to that after all the shots had been fired out of it? Like, had he run out of ammunition and then smashed it, or was it smashed and actually not used, and the person who was shooting was actually using different rifles? So in the police interview, they pull up the AR-15, and he says, yeah, Martin says, yep, that's mine, I own that. And they say, what about this shotgun? He says, yeah, I paid $3,000 for it. And then they say, now this is a 308 FN weapon. And he says, that's not mine, I've never seen it before. And they're sure. Never, 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 never. I've never seen it before. It's nice, though. He denies it seven times. And if we were having a religious debate, you could say that seven is the number of completion. He completely denies ever seeing this FN rifle. And they then say, oh, hang on a minute. Let's put this scope on the top. Do you recognize it now? And he's like, no, I've never seen that scope before. That's not one of mine. So my question is, if he's lying and denying the FN FAL, what's the motivation behind it? Okay, he's already admitted to the AR-15. He's admitted to the shotgun. So he's already his head's in the noose. Okay, why deny the third one? What benefit is there, unless he's telling the truth? And in his memory, he didn't shoot anybody with the rifle or the shotgun. And this other rifle, never seen it before. The issue is the cops then drop it like a hot potato and go on to something else. So they never follow up this mystery rifle that just appears out of nowhere in the gutter outside Seascape after it's all over. And then the reason we know about this is that it wasn't released in the original batch of photos from the crime scene. New Idea magazine, of all people. Now, did Kerry Packer own New Idea? I can't remember. Anyway, whoever it was owned New Idea, thank you very much for your benevolence. New Idea in 2006 ran a 10-year anniversary special, dancing in the blood of the victims, blaming guns. You can imagine the heart-tearing, heart-rending kind of tripe that they published. But one thing they published was this photo in colour of this rifle sitting in the gutter, which was, the photo was taken by a journalist at the time, published previously until now. So it just sat in the archives, waiting. Now, I don't know about you, but I've read a bit about police crime scene. I've watched a bit of CSI and all of that. And all, every detective show, what do they put around the outside of the crime scene? Yellow tape. And what does it say on the tape? What's that yellow and black tape?
What's that?
Adam?
Mm-hmm.
What's on the tape? Any crime scene, they put this tape.
Oh, yeah, do not enter. Yeah. Black.
What does it say? Crime scene.
Crime scene,
do not cross.
do not cross. And
so you can watch any TV show, any criminal TV show. The media is on the outside and they've got cameras and the detectives, there's a sergeant or a constable who lifts the tape and the detectives go underneath and they flash their badge. You know how it happens? So that's police procedure. Seal off the crime scene. Forensics go through the crime scene and they collect up all the evidence. They take photos of everything and only then do they let the media in. Well, that didn't happen here. The media have gone in. There's a journalist taking photos of a rifle still in the crime scene. The police forensics guys hadn't even noticed it was there. They hadn't even finished their preliminary work. And the media are traipsing through, contaminating the crime scene. That of itself is grounds for a retrial, or at least an expression of skepticism in the police investigation.
Oh, that's right. You're mentioning New Idea and stuff. That's just bringing flashbacks to me. I was just searching for stuff. It's such old material. It's hard, but there's this flash in my mind that I remember some of this. It really is incredible.
Yep. So there's this rifle left in the crime scene. Kelly Lane is back in the news the last couple of days because the Innocence Project is trying to get her case retried because of police incompetence in the investigation. So if Kelly Lane can be accused of murdering her baby and simply because the birth wasn't registered, she's serving a prison term now. If she can get her case looked at based on the fact that the police didn't do a good enough investigation to exonerate her, we should be able to do the same thing. The simple fact that the police did not take Bryant back to the crime scene and video him confessing each step of the way. Where were you? Which way was the rifle pointed? Who did you shoot? What did you do then? Da-da-da-da-da-da. That's standard police procedure, and there's a timestamp on the video so that it can be transcribed and put into evidence to say, this is how the guy admitted doing it. That wasn't done. The crime scene's contaminated. We've got this mystery rifle that didn't belong to Martin Bryant. He did own another rifle in .308 caliber, the AR-10, but it was in Terry Hill's gun shop being repaired because he didn't know what bullets to put in it, and he put the wrong kind of bullets in it and jammed it. We're talking about a guy who knows almost nothing about firearms, and yet we're supposed to understand that he pulled off this massacre using different firearms at different ranges without using the telescopic sight because it would have blocked his vision. Anyway, I'm getting to the best bit. The seascape catches fire and Martin Bryant crawls out burning, and the police come up and arrest him and zip tie his hands together and put him in the ambulance, take him away. In the ambulance, he has an escort of two special operations group commandos from the Tasmanian police, Malcolm Scott and Paul Hawkins. I'm going to read a little bit from Paul Hawkins' witness statement. Okay. During the course of escorting Bryant to the Royal Hobart Hospital, conversation occurred with him in the rear of the ambulance. I recorded this conversation in my notebook as it occurred. That's the duty of any police officer, is to just write it down. You don't make any judgment about it. You just record what's happening. The ambulance officer said, "What's your name?" Bryant said, "Martin Bryant," and asked, "What's the point of all this?" The ambulance officer said, "I preserved life, Martin. Have you been drinking alcohol?" Bryant said, "A bit. It hurts. I want to get out of here." Bryant said, "Where is she?" I said, "Who?" So this is the cop asks Bryant, "Who? Who are you talking about?" Bryant said, "Petra. Petra, did she get out of the fire? Petra's my girlfriend. We always stick together." I said, "Was Petra in the fire?" Bryant said, "Yes, she was in the house." Bryant made further comments, but his speech was incoherent. The ambulance officer asked questions in relation to Bryant's medical situation. So, you asked about Petra before. There are major question marks over this young lady's involvement. Here's a guy who's in pain. He's not capable of forming any sort of cunning plan or a lie. He's in pain. All he's concerned about is, where's my girlfriend? She was in the house. The house is on fire. Is she okay? So that asks the question, was she in the house? What was she doing in the house? When did she leave? How did she get there? She's denied it. And as far as Petra is concerned, she was at her parents' place all day and then went to the police station in the night with Carlene to make a statement. So there's this again, there's reasonable doubt. This is what I keep coming back to. I can't prove much of this. I'm not even really trying to. All I'm trying to show people is what you've been told in the media is not what actually happened. There's a lot of things in this case that just make you shake your head saying there's something else is going on. This is bigger than just one guy who shot a bunch of people because he felt angry at the world. There's so much more going on here. There's the soap powder decoy, the extra rifles. There's the Petra being in the fire. And we've only scratched on the surface. I'm not trying to bamboozle people. But all of that is basically what I've covered in the book. And it just reads like an action thriller. So you get a bit of character development at the start. We see who this guy is. And then the massacre takes place. And the book ends basically as the sun's coming up on the Monday. The other thing that I just want to touch on is the management seminar. Okay, 10 of the top managers at the Port Arthur Historic Site were instructed to attend a training seminar on Sunday night and Monday at Swansea, which is miles up the coast, 2 hours' drive away. Now, I want to ask you a question, Adam. What kind of government department has a work function on a Sunday afternoon? Anybody that you ever heard of?
Not so much now.
No, there's not the common timing thing. Of this. Mm. We talked about the timing of the morgue van, the refrigerated morgue truck. The timing of that is very curious.
We had your barbecue as well, this, you know, and this as
the
well.
The police barbecue, the timing of this seminar for public servants, this is a department, basically the tourism department of Tasmania, to go on a Sunday afternoon sleepover to Monday night junket. I've tried to contact the woman who organised it. Her name's on the Margaret Jacobs. No reply. And it's the same with any witnesses that I've tried to contact. They simply do not respond, which is very sad. If anybody's listening to this and you have any information, please contact me. My email address is in the book. It's on my website. It's on Facebook. You can contact me. Completely confidential, I assure you. The witness statements that I've used in my book, where there's not a published witness statement, I've kept it confidential. But if you know anything, if you are aware of anything that might help or might be related, please let us know. That's the management seminar. But I wanted to just raise something else that's come out of left field and has prompted me to maybe look at it in a bit of a different light. Adam, are you aware of Project MK Ultra?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, it's to do with hypnosis and mind control and LSD drugs.
Triggering,
and things, right?
Yeah.
And it's, and it's been going for a long, long time. Since World War II, they've been researching this, right? And this includes unwilling human testing in prisons, testing in universities, testing in mental hospitals. Okay. So so I received a message from some people who had been on the ferry and they boarded the ferry, and it was about to pull away, and this young man dashed up to the dock with a big bag and blonde hair and wanted to get onto the ferry. And the captain said, "We're full. I can't take you." And he swore and got up overly upset, like, "There's another ferry coming in an hour, dude. Just wait." But his reaction seemed out of proportion to the frustration that he was experiencing. He stormed up and down, muttering to himself. Anyway, they didn't think anything of it. The ferry pulled away. And the next thing they knew, there'd been this shooting. Right. Now, inside the Volvo, when they found it, there was two jerry cans half full of petrol and a packet of little Lucifer fire lighters, that waxy compressed kerosene, yeah? And what I'm thinking is, after researching a bit of MKUltra and putting myself into the position of an evil psychiatrist, maybe they were aiming for the ferry, but not necessarily the ferry, but the wooden jetty. So at Port Arthur, the water's still pretty deep, and there's a rock wall, and then the timber jetty goes out at right angles, and then there's a T-junction at the end. It's all timber. So the water's pretty deep. It's not like it's a long jetty. And I'm thinking maybe the experiment involved taking the guns down to the jetty where there's a queue of American tourists lined up. There was busloads of American tourists there that day.
Mm-hmm. Japanese. And what if
they timed it? Not so many Japanese, but there was
a lot
some,
of Americans.
A lot of Americans. Some Vietnam vets were there as well, right? So if you're queued up, if there's 182 people queued up on this wooden jetty, men, women, and children.
Where were they going, Oscar, by the way?
Out to the Isle of the Dead.
Isle of the Dead, yep.
Yep, which is a graveyard out there. But that was where the Bundina went. The Bundina went out and back to the Isle of the Dead. But there were other ferries that day on the water doing other cruises out to the west and up to the north. Okay, so there were several boats on the water. So there's 182 people. Let's just say this is what happened, right? There's 182 people queued up on the dock waiting for the ferry to come back in.
Mm.
And the ferry's carrying another 182 people. They're all queued up, and some lunatic stands on the shore near the end of the jetty and starts laying into the crowd with an automatic rifle, a semi-automatic rifle. And he's got plenty of ammunition, he's got a couple of different calibers, and he's got a shotgun in case anybody gets too close. If you're standing on the jetty and someone starts shooting at you, what are you going to do?
Jump in the water.
Yes. That's what I do. You're going to jump in the water along with everybody else,
yeah.
Terrified, screaming. You're taking giant panic breaths. And the water is freezing, right? This is Tasmania.
Sure is.
It's down there, right? So you've got people choking and splashing and drowning in the water as their nervous systems get overwhelmed with terror and cold, right? He then gets the two jerry cans of petrol and throws them like a discus out onto the water. And he puts a couple of holes in each. So the petrol is now floating on top of the water with all of these people around. And he gets a little Lucifer fire lighter and lights it up with a cigarette lighter that he bought at Angelos Karasus's newsagent earlier that day. And he throws it in on top of the petrol. Boof! The entire surface of the water bursts into flame. And you're in it.
Mm-hmm.
So you then face what we call a Faustian paradox. Do you drown yourself under the water and your children and your loved ones to prevent them the pain of burning alive? Or do you try and swim away and risk being burnt alive yourself, choking because the fire would burn up all the oxygen? For an evil psychiatrist who's been doing human experiments on people, that's an interesting thing to watch from the safety of the cafe just up the road, isn't it?
Mm.
The artifacts are there. They found the petrol and the fire lighters in the back of his car. Martin didn't own the fire lighters. He had them in his house at home. He didn't take them with him in the car. Someone else brought them. And he had no explanation for how the BMW caught fire because he doesn't carry matches or a lighter in his pockets because he didn't smoke. But somebody did. So I reckon that it's possible. The original plan was to do this – horrendous social science experiment on people, on American tourists, and link it to gun control. Look how crazy these gun nuts are. Look how mentally ill a sadistic person with an AR-15 is. We'd better ban them all right now. Okay, it's a nice media bite. You've got pictures of burnt children. The media would just have a field day with all of those pictures, right? So this is where the operation gets ballsed up, either inadvertently or deliberately. Either he missed the ferry deliberately and came back to the cafe, or he missed the ferry and he missed the queue. I mean, so you understand, once the ferry's leaving, the people are no longer on the dock. So the opportunity's gone. He has to wait for over an hour for the next lot of people to build up on the ferry. So in the court transcript, the prosecutor says that Anthony Nightingale stood up when the shooting happened and he said, "No, no, not here," before the shooter took aim and shot him in the throat. Now, Anthony Nightingale is one of the several people inside the cafe that we strongly suspect is an ASIO agent. And his actions on the day indicate that he knew that something was supposed to happen and it was not supposed to happen inside the cafe. And his terror got the best of him and he just reacted, as completely understandably. And the shooter made a graceful and elegant statement as if to say, "Shut your hole," by literally shooting him through the throat to say, "Stop giving the game away." Was that a lucky shot? It's possible, but there's so many question marks around this, and the skill of the shooter, if he was a point shooter, that would be easy enough to do, to just track along, go boom, 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 boom. So that then sent a very clear message to everyone involved. If you don't toe the official line, you'll be the next victim. Because if they can do this to five of our own, they can do it to anybody. Tony Kiston was shot and killed in the cafe. He was a member of the South African Communist Party who had fled to Australia and was doing communist things in Australia. He was killed. Dennis Olsen was wounded. He was a gun control advocate from America. There's just, what's the odds of three or four ASIO agents, a South African communist and an American gun control agent, to be in the same place in the middle of nowhere when this all happens? Okay, there's possibility, there's probability, and then there's stretching the bounds of, you've got to be kidding me.
That's right.
Yeah. So there's, I hope I haven't scared people with the possibilities here. I'm not saying any of this actually happened. I'm just saying, here's the evidence. Is any of this possible, plausible? That's what my book deals with.
I was looking at that ages ago there, Oscar, about the ferry. Not from, obviously, your information, just other that I was looking at. And it's, so you're talking about the same thing that I was looking at years ago, that it may have been the original target and there was some kind of change of plan, that something went wrong there and they moved it to the cafe. Yep. And what you're talking about there as well with the shooter shooting the man in the throat, maybe he was getting orders that this is what we're doing now. And as you said, that's that double crossing thing going on, that the orders were changed and the shooter changed and that this was the way to go now.
Yes. So who those people were giving the orders, I don't know. I can take a few guesses. If you look around the media, you can see who's really pushing for gun control around the world. You've got Michael Bloomberg, you've got George Soros, you've got the Rothschilds, you've got Rupert Murdoch, the big media corporations, the people who profit from misery and social problems. And these are people who are trying to force a certain ideology on the world, which a lot of people don't think is in their best interests. So to send a message to our government to say, we are really in control, and if you push back against us, you're going to be next. It worked. If that's what the intention was, it worked, because Australia has since been very, very closely aligned with the UN on all of their initiatives, from selling off our private industry and our land, to massive immigration, to the elimination of self-defense, pretty much anyway. Mm-hmm. So, I'm not a big conspiracy theorist. ideal in facts, some of which I'm not opposed to. You know, if there is, I'm certainly sure there are rich and powerful people who are trying to do their business around the world and benefit themselves. And what they're doing is not necessarily in the best interest of everyone else. Does that mean there's a global conspiracy of, you know, lizard people? I don't think so. I'm just looking here at what happened, what's the evidence telling me, and how much padding do I need to put in? What's the biggest leap, or what's the shortest leap to join the dots?
Could I ask you this, just to create a side note? It's a horrible thing to ask, but people have actually commented on my site, and I've heard people say this because you get a lot of, in America, in particular, you get a lot of shootings in America where people are saying they're false flags. We just had a knife attack in Melbourne, which seems very staged. I don't know. It was a very funny one. But we get these attacks, particularly in America, where people say no one actually died. There were actually staged events with these actors. People say that about Tasmania. And obviously, this is a terrible thing to ask. It being in the 90s, it seemed like, that it was absolutely a real event. What's your thoughts to those people who say that no people died in Port Arthur, that it was a staged event to bring in gun control as well?
I think people died. I've seen photos.
I do as well.
I've seen Carol Lawton on TV, and she lost her daughter Sarah. And there's no, you know, she's not faking. She's absolutely still traumatized, and my heart breaks for that poor woman. So I've got no doubt that people actually died in Port Arthur. The people who talk about America, I honestly don't know. America is a different planet in so many ways that it's possible that these crisis actors that we talk about, people crying, honestly, I've seen a lot of the, you know, there's like three photos that's supposed to be of the same person in three different locations. And I'm like, yeah, it doesn't really have to be the same person. It might not be the same person. So I'd be the first to say that Adam Lanza, the Batman shooter, he has got more things in common with MK Ultra than Martin Bryant does. But there's a lot of similarities there. The lack of memory, the robotic movements.
That's true. That's
things
true.
Like that.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I've seen it before. That's very true.
So there's another option, yeah, which I have considered, and that is that Martin Bryant did it. And he shot all those people, and then he drove to Seascape, and the place caught fire, and he doesn't remember it. If that is the case, and here's where I deal in possibilities and probabilities, right? It is possible to program a human being through hypnosis to shoot somebody and not remember it.
Yeah.
Okay, Darren Brown, have you seen that The Assassin show?
Not so much, no.
No? Okay, Darren Brown is a performing hypnotist, right? He's a showman. Mm-hmm. Okay, but you go on YouTube and you type in Darren Brown, The Assassin, and basically he gets a room full of people and he whittles them down and whittles them down and whittles them down, and he gets one guy, because he says you can't, the general rule of hypnosis is you can't hypnotize somebody to do something they don't ordinarily want to do or they wouldn't ordinarily do, right? And he says that's true for most of the population, but there are some who you can. Long story short, he gets this guy and over a period of time hypnotizes him to be a better shooter than the woman at the gun range. Is like, I can't believe somebody shot that well on their first trip to the gun range. Anyway, long story short, they kill a celebrity who is in on it and is wearing a dye pack, but they kill a celebrity on camera and the guy has no memory of it. And they play the video of him pulling the trigger to him later. And he gets this massive grin on his face because he just cannot believe what his eyes are seeing. That's me on the screen with a pistol shooting somebody and I've got no memory of it. You've seen on YouTube the videos of Martin saying, and the police say it's not funny, Martin. You've seen that little YouTube clip, Martin Bryant pleads guilty. It's the similar kind of smile, the smile of disbelief.
Yeah.
What you're telling me, I don't understand. There's photos of my car there where I never was. And his face involuntarily smiles because he's incredulous. It just, he's suspending his belief. So Sirhan shot Robert F. Kennedy in the pantry of the hotel in LA and has no memory of it. So they were able to do that back in the 60s. They were able to program Sirhan Sirhan to do a thing and not remember it. Derren Brown can program this guy. I believe Adam Lanza was similarly programmed to do it and not remember it. And if Martin Bryant was the man who pulled the trigger and got that incredible accuracy inside the cafe, which I don't believe he did because his testimony doesn't add up, but if it was him, then he was doing it under this similar type of MKUltra hypnosis, which don't call me a conspiracy theorist for mentioning MKUltra. They've declassified the documents. The US government has paid victims compensation money for the unwitting experiments that were performed upon them. So the US government doesn't pay out alien abductees. The US government doesn't pay out people who make things up, like the false memory people of the preschool. If you do a Google search for preschool abuse scandal or something, there was a woman in America who was doing memory hypnosis, and she remembered all of this horrible trauma that had happened to her, and it turned out that none of it had happened. It was all implanted by the hypnotist in the power of suggestion. So these things all combine together and give us the understanding that it's possible to do that with somebody and get the same result of what we've talked about today, that the evidence that's all there, if Martin was hypnotized, sort of wound up like a cog, a spring in the back of him, and sent off from 12:40 p.m. at Seascape, he drove down to Port Arthur under the power of hypnosis, shot all of the people in the cafe, came back to the Seascape, and then had his memory wiped and was abandoned inside asleep until the place burnt down. That's consistent with the evidence that we see. Is it plausible with the other witness statements? Jim Laycock said it wasn't him. Graham Collier said it wasn't him. So that's why I went with the body double shooter, someone who looked like Bryant, but it actually wasn't him. Bryant was unconscious in Seascape the whole time. Yeah. So do you want to read the interview transcript for a minute or two?
I will. I was just going to mentioned something here as well. It was an article I put up a while ago, and it was so bloody popular. So many comments and people sharing this. It was the source was from Cairns News, and it was about startling new information proves Port Arthur massacre was planned by government. Just for people who haven't read this, I'll just go through the top bit. It says in 1988, New South Wales Premier Barry Umsworth said it will take a massacre in Tasmania before we will be able to introduce gun laws. In March 1996, less than a month before the massacre at Port Arthur, the Gun Coalition's Tasmanian coordinator, Mr. Roland Brown, wrote to the Hobart Mercury newspaper warning of a Dublin-style massacre in Tasmania unless the gun laws were changed. And that was from the Australian newspaper. So this is implicating people within the Howard government or Howard regime at that time that knew about this event as well. A very worrying article that there was prior knowledge here as well. This was, of course, by Keith Allen Noble, who wrote a book on Port Arthur as well.
Just keep it on. To be brutally fair to the facts, I'm happy to blame John Howard for a lot of things that he did wrong, but he had only been Prime Minister for a couple of months. So this, I believe this was planned long before him. And
do you think he had some kind of knowledge, John Howard?
Personally, I think they said to him, mushroom treatment, don't worry your head about it. We're looking after it. You just toe the line and say what we tell you to say, and you will be dead before the records are unsealed.
So it's these shadowy kind of people within the Liberal and Labor Party. We hear the guys behind the scenes who are kind of doing the shadow puppet sort of thing with the Prime Ministers, you know?
Yeah. Personally, I don't think it was an Australian invention. I think it came from overseas.
Yeah, well, it was someone definitely wanted to disarm Australia, that's for sure.
Yeah, see, I agree with that, but I also think that the people wanted to traumatise Australia.
Exactly.
See, MKUltra is all about trauma and using trauma to change personalities. And that's what psychiatrists are all about, changing personalities, agents of social control. I think it was Paul Mullen gave a paper on the psychiatrists as agents of social control. These people see themselves as gods, benignly, in their view, changing society in order to make it a better place. Well, a better place according to who? According to them. So as far as they're concerned, you've got to break a few eggs to make an omelette. But I personally don't think this was a homegrown thing. I think that the influence came from overseas, because we've seen similar elements of planning in America more recently. We've also seen Anders Behring Breivik in Norway, who did an almost identical attack on an island with a semi-automatic rifle and killed a whole bunch of politicians' kids on that island. Interestingly enough, even after that horrendous massacre, Norway did not ban or restrict semi-automatic rifles at all. And they have not had another incident like that. So for people to say, oh, Australia banned guns and that's why we're all safer, is actually statistically is not supported by the facts. New Zealand had a massacre in 1997. They did not ban semi-automatic rifles. They haven't had one since. Norway had a horrible massacre in 2000 and something, whatever it was, did not ban semi-automatic rifles, have not had one since. You mentioned in the article the Dunblane massacre. It's not Dublin, it's Dunblane, Scotland.
Yeah. Dublane.
A lot of people understand that was a horrible shooting that happened just before Port Arthur, which is true. But a lot of people don't understand the background to that. The man was a pedophile. And the police had refused his gun license on the grounds that he wasn't a fit and proper person. And he had tried to set up his own boys scouting network, like his own personal version of the Boy Scouts. Correct. And he'd taken photos of boys in their swimwear. Yep. He was a pervert, absolute pervert. And his local society was turning against him, and he could feel it. And he snapped. And he basically said, well, I'm going to die and take a whole bunch of people with me, and I'm going to hurt you in the most vulnerable place that you've got, which is your children. And that's what he did. So to blame all British law-abiding gun owners and sporting shooters for the actions of an absolute criminal, depraved pedophile is just wrong. And yet the media got onto it. The media has very, very clever people. These are people who have degrees in psychiatry and manipulation and subliminal programming, and that the media did their thing and they banned all pistols, and now you've got a knife epidemic because everybody's stabbing each other instead of shooting each other. Just crazy. As an aside to people who are of the opinion that gun laws stop gun crime, consider the area of Northern Ireland. The area of Northern Ireland's a few square kilometres, okay, maybe 50 square kilometres, encircled completely on all sides by the United Kingdom. The British government controls the waterways, the roads, and they have an extensive spy network, and yet the IRA waged a war against the British government for 50 years. A relentless campaign of shootings and bombings, and the British SAS soldiers who were in Northern Ireland did not have to operate under the Geneva Convention. In Ireland, a whole bunch of firearms were banned. If you were even suspected of having an IRA member in your family, you lost your license and your firearms were seized. You had to have a club owning a shotgun. Northern Ireland was like a quarantined war zone for 50 years. Incredible. It didn't stop them smuggling in AK-47s from Libya.
That's right. Yeah.
It didn't stop them going to Libya and training on how to blow people up. And then they drove a truck into England with three mortars in the back of the dump truck. And they lined it up and they fired the mortars when Parliament was in session. And one of them fell short and exploded in the garden and smashed all the windows. One of them overshot and fell in the garden on the other side. The one that hit the roof was a dud. It didn't go off. If it had gone off, it would have killed John Major and the Deputy Prime Minister, half the cabinet would have been killed. It was just pure, whether it was an act of God or pure luck, whatever you believe, the IRA got three mortars to within bombing range of the UK Parliament, lined it up and set it off, and then destroyed the truck and got away before anybody saw them. And one of the British artillery people that they interviewed later on grudgingly admitted that anybody he knew would have had a difficult time lining that up unseen, just first go, boom. So for anybody who thinks, oh, Australia's strong gun laws have stopped, you know, kept us all safe and stopped the mass shootings, I'm sorry, you're wrong. It's other factors. And the gun laws did not stop the IRA from waging a very successful war against the British, and it will not stop the mass shootings in America. You cannot put the toothpaste back in the tube. Everybody must take personal responsibility for their own safety. You can't outsource it to laws. You can't outsource it to the police. When you need the police, they're minutes away. It's just sad that there seems to be a persistent trend of abdicating personal responsibility. Sorry if I'm ranting, but I just feel that everyone's their own first responder, and everybody should take responsibility for their own family safety.
That's right. I agree absolutely, 100%. Indeed. And well said. And we'll push it a little bit more, the podcast, because you wanted to go over some videotape interview with Martin Bryan at Risdon Prison.
Yes.
Just before that, if you could just tie in this a little bit, because it's so important, and I wanted you to talk about this. I'll just mention this website as well, and I'll put it up with the podcast. It's portarthurinquiry.blogspot.com. This is the Port Arthur Inquiry blog that you've created, and it's full of information that we're talking about tonight. And I wanted to ask you just to go through a little timeline here for folks about the tabletop incident with the blue sports bag and everything that was left in the cafe, and the tray of food, the solo drink, and this for folks, because it's something that I've looked at for years. But the details are fascinating here, and I know a lot of people look at this because it's pretty strong evidence. Mention this a little bit, information.
Okay. I'm glad you brought that up, because it's another, you know, you can get bogged down in conspiracy theories or who did what or who did what, but this is evidence, okay? Yeah. This is just pure, simple evidence, okay? So the shooter drove the yellow Volvo down and paid the entry fee, parked in down near the jetty, and then bought a ticket for the ferry and went into the cafe, the Broad Arrow Cafe, got in the queue with a big bag on his back. He gets to the queue and he ordered a big meal. Apparently there was two plates of food, a drink, a cup of juice, and a can of Solo. And he took the tray outside onto the veranda where there was some seating. And someone opened the door for him, and he thanked them, and they had a bit of a chit-chat in passing. Oh, you know, she said, oh, you've got a big meal. And he said, yeah, I've been surfing all morning. And then he went out onto the sofa, onto the balcony, and ate his meal, and just made banal chit-chat, you know, talking to himself, just talking at the people who were sitting around him. And that's where the phrase wasps, there's a lot of wasps here, not many nips, is some phrase that this guy said. He finishes his meal, and then he picks up the tray with a video camera on it. So he's had a big black backpack on his back and a camcorder that's not in a case, it's just a free camcorder. And he puts the camcorder on the tray with his empty plate and utensils and the empty Solo can. He goes back inside the cafe and puts it on a table. He puts the bag on the table next to him, and it appears from the witness statements that there was a blue sports bag inside the black duffel bag, because he sort of takes the big duffel bag out and the blue duffel bag out of the black backpack, picks up the AR-15, turns around and just starts shooting at people. Leaves the camera on the tray, leaves the Solo, the plate, and continues shooting, and then gets back in his car and drives out to the toll booth. So that tray is prime evidence of the shooter. It's going to have his DNA on the fork where it went into his mouth. It's going to have his fingerprints on the can and the DNA on the little ring pull thing where he's put it in his mouth and drunk out of it. None of that was tested for DNA or fingerprints. None of that evidence was presented in court because there was no trial. The defence could not requisition that. It's probably, hopefully, still locked in evidence. with someone else's fingerprints and DNA on it. But certainly, if you want to talk about police procedure and exonerating evidence, there's evidence on that tray that can either condemn or exonerate Martin and put an end to all these conspiracy theories. If he did it, then he's where he should be, and I'll shut up and go away. I'll be happy. If his DNA is on that tray, release it. What are you afraid of? But it hasn't been, and that's why the questions persist.
You've got so the pictures these... there as well. There's an actual picture there.
Yeah.
That's police evidence.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Right there.
Yeah. So there's, and that's, if you go to liveleak.com, you can view the police training video. It has a warning, like a trigger warning, because there's video of, you know, dead bodies and things. But the video that the police took is there on liveleak.com.
I've seen that. Mm.
Yeah.
That's incredible. That's a really, really incredible thing, man. I mean, here you have the actual killer sitting in the cafe. Cameras, you've got bags, you've got a drink, you've got a tray of food, and none of it was submitted. I mean, it's right there. It's wow.
Yep.
And it's not like it's made up. There's the picture. I'm looking at it.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. But I've just about got to go. We've got about 5 minutes left, and happy to come back at a later time. But,
If
you're happy to run through this video transcript, we'll just do. Do you want to be Martin or do you want to be the cops? Do you want to be?
I'll be the cops. Why not?
All right. All right, so this, we're just going to read through the transcript as if it's a play, and I'll be Martin Bryant answering the questions, and Adam's going to be the cops asking the questions.
What page are you going to go from?
So we start at the page 98 is the printed one. I think it's 116 with texter on the top. And the text at the top of the page says they wouldn't be likely to get it wrong. And then the cop says, that leads me and Mr. Warren perhaps to some important matters. So if you can find that and...
116?
Yeah, 116 is the texter on the top. Or if you're looking at the typed numbers, it's 98. There's a few pages missing.
It's 98 with the actual type number?
Yeah.
Give us a look. Wow, there's lots, isn't there? Yeah. Okay. They wouldn't be likely to get it wrong.
Yep. Okay. That's right. Okay. So the police then say.
That's right.
And then yes, so you then read the next bit. That leads me.
Here we go. That leads me and Mr. Warren perhaps to some important matters.
And then you ask the question. So Warren is then Q. You ask me.
Warren, so at Port Arthur on that particular day.
What happened at Port Arthur?
Well, you're saying to us that you didn't go to Port Arthur, did you?
No, I didn't.
And you're quite definite.
I didn't go. I definitely didn't go to Port Arthur.
Well, what would you say if?
I wouldn't. I wouldn't pay the money to go in. I would have if I didn't have to pay money.
Well, what would you say if I told you that you were seen going into Port Arthur and, in fact, you were at the toll gate?
I couldn't have been.
And more than that, that you did complain about the price of admission.
I don't remember going into Port Arthur or going through the toll gate at all.
Well, as you said a minute ago, you were... Your description of the long blonde hair does make you stand out from the crowd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
What about your yellow Volvo?
Yeah, that would stand out, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Had me surfboard on top of it. I drove straight past.
Well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have lots of people who are telling us that they saw you at Port Arthur and your car.
Well, it must have been another. There's other Volvos.
With surfboards on the top?
No, there's not many with surfboards on top.
With someone with long blonde hair driving them? Or getting out of them?
There's not many with surfboards on top.
You don't recall, huh? Someone in Port Arthur, when you pulled your car up, talking to you about you're not allowed to park your car where you put it.
No, not at all.
Is it possible that you could have been in there, do you think?
Definitely not possible.
Why do you say that?
Because I remember driving straight past. Martin Bryant.
Martin, what if I said to you that neither Inspector Payne or myself believe that you're saying to us?
You don't believe one little thing.
No, but we don't believe that you're what you're telling us now about not being in Port Arthur.
Mm-mm. All I can say is mm-mm.
Why do you think?
Mm-mm.
Why do you think we would not believe you?
I don't really know. I can't understand.
Martin, I want you to have a look at this photo. It's a photo number 0112. In it is a car I believe to be yours. It's depicted adjacent to the toll booth.
Couldn't be mine. Where'd you get that? I don't remember being stationary. Mm-mm.
Do you agree that could be a surfboard on top?
Yes, I think it probably is.
And it's certainly similar to your car.
Mm-hmm.
The registration number of this vehicle, I think, is CG2835.
No, I don't remember the registration.
Well, that's your car. So, that certainly suggests, it because that's the exit road at the toll booth, that your car had been.
How could the car be there when I didn't go there in the first place?
As I've said, there are lots of people saying that they saw you in Port Arthur site. In the Port Arthur site, and your car in the Port Arthur site.
I can't recall that.
Did you go to the Broad Arrow Cafe?
The last time I've been into the Broad Arrow Cafe was about, I can't recall, must have been 2 to 3 years ago.
Once again?
Because I haven't taken any of my girlfriends down there, not at all.
Do you remember going there about the end of March this year?
No. Was I there in March or what?
Well, I'm asking you.
No.
Once again, lots of people are saying they saw you in the Broad Arrow Cafe on Sunday, the 28th of April.
Mm-mm, that's untrue.
It's untrue, is it?
Mm-hmm.
And why do you say that, Martin?
Because I didn't. I drove straight past.
So how do you account for the car being there?
That lady could have driven it down there. That one, the wife or girlfriend of the chap I took hostage, because I said, get into the Volvo.
Mm. Martin?
Like I was telling you before, it's true.
I believe that you took the BMW near the toll booth, not on the highway.
Mm-mm, I wasn't there that afternoon.
And what's more, I can tell you we have spoken to the people that say the car was taken from the toll booth area.
It's not true.
Must have been someone else's. How many people were in the BMW?
There was a lady, I don't recall if it's a boy or a girl, and a man. There's three people altogether.
Could have been four?
No, definitely three.
How many women did you see?
In the BMW?
Hmm.
There was the lady and the child. I forget whether the child was a boy or a girl.
Martin, I believe you went to the Broad Arrow Cafe at Port Arthur on Sunday the 28th.
Nonsense. Like I said, I didn't go to Port Arthur. Let's just hold it there. I think we're just about out of time. But you can see quite clearly he's denying his memory's fine. He remembers driving straight past.
Absolutely.
And what he describes about taking the BMW is nothing like what actually happened at the toll booth, according to Nicholas Chiok's witness statement, which tells me he wasn't there. And he took the BMW at a different place. And the woman and the child that he talks about, this is tying into what you said before, were crisis actors who were in on it. They've never come forward and said, hey, some crazy guy kidnapped us in our BMW. But if he took the BMW at Fortescue Bay and drove it down to the base of operations and was then knocked out and then a lookalike got in it and drove into Port Arthur, the timing matches.
Absolutely.
Mm.
Very interesting. Yeah.
So there's plenty more of the rabbit hole that we can go down, but I think we've covered it. I've got to go. But,
yeah, we can definitely do that. Am I able to share this videotape interview at Risdon Prison?
Absolutely. There's a link to it on my blog, and the PDF is there. And if you want to read my book, it's on lulu.com or Amazon. You just search for The Second Empty Chair, Oscar Zimmerman, you'll find it.
Absolutely. Anything else you want to mention before we plug out?
Keep an open mind. I'm not saying that the book is what actually happened. I'm just saying there's a lot of questions here, and they constitute reasonable doubt. And Martin Bryant, under our democratic system, is deemed to be innocent until proven guilty. He was not proven guilty, and there is reasonable doubt that he did it, and a proper investigation is required and warranted.
Thanks so much, Oscar, for chatting with me tonight, and for the work you're doing in your own quiet way. And it's these little bits and pieces that are so interesting that you're bringing up, these little details in the case. We know about all the other things, but this has really been fascinating. So thanks so much for this. And we'll catch up again possibly in the new year when you're not so busy, and we'll continue maybe.
Look forward to it.
With this information. Thanks so much, buddy.